What's up, Wing Wing Nation? This is Joe here. We are cooking up a national tour, but we need some info from you. So if you click the link below, there's a survey. We need to know which cities to go to. If you want us to go to your hometown, let us know in the survey below and we will consider it. It takes like 30 seconds and you get 10% off our online store if you complete it. And come see us live in person. We're going to have car meets. We're going to have contests. We're going to have sim racing. It's going to be so fun. So let us know where to go. Get 10% off merch and it's a win-win. And let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Big Three. We have a very special guest for you guys this week. You may know him from Roadkill and Hot Rod Magazine, as well as a ton of other publications. It's the one and only David Freiberger is here on the show. Welcome, David, to the
show. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Thanks for coming, man.
Wow. This is peanut gallery. Even.
We need a mic back there. Yeah, this is awesome. As we were talking before the show, and I really credit Hot Rod Magazine as one of the reasons that I'm even into cars at all. Very cool to have you here, man.
Thank you.
I think you've influenced us at Donut. Like a lot of our build shows kind of mirror Roadkill a little bit.
Not
that level of expertise. But the budget builds is what we're all about. And I think that definitely you guys were a huge inspiration for us.
Yeah, not just inspiration for us, but I mean, how many people I think on YouTube now credit you and Roadkill for inspiring them and their output? You know, you guys certainly pioneered the find a car in a side yard, get it running and take it on a road trip somewhere. I mean, I don't think it's an understatement to say that you are like one of the most influential people in the car scene right now.
That might be a little bit generous, but I appreciate it.
I stand by it, man.
It's one of those things where you don't want to like break your arm patting yourself on the back, but I will say it has been one of the most rewarding parts of my career is all of the people who will tell me kind of what you just said, which was, you know, I wouldn't be into cars if I hadn't seen you guys, or I bonded with my dad over watching your shows. And so that was a big thing. And, you know, that's unintentional on our part. We just sort of did what we did and made the show and people connected to it. And yeah, it sort of spawned a lot of the stuff that's happening on YouTube today. Yeah.
How did you dip your toe, I guess, first? Was there anything before publishing or the magazine business, or how did it all start for David Freiberger?
Well, the earth cooled. Dinosaurs roamed. I have never had a job that wasn't cars. I took high school auto shop and was really unusual because I also took high school drama. I remember my counselor said, "What are you doing here? You're the only guy we've ever seen in AP English and auto shop." They literally told me auto shop is for the gang members and losers.
Whoa.
I mean, literally, that's what they said to me.
And but where did you grow up?
Here in LA. Oh, cool. Born in Hollywood, grew up around here.
Yeah.
And so I was really primed for this the whole time. As soon as I graduated high school, I worked at a Dodge dealership as a parts delivery boy, and I ended up working the parts counter. And while I was doing that, I was a magazine junkie. I bought used old magazines, which is weird because this is about 1983, and I was buying magazines from 1965 to 1970, and they seemed really old. Of course, they were younger than if you bought a 2020 edition of Hot Rod right now, but at the time, it seemed like it was just a completely different era, and so I was a junkie addicted to those old magazines. And when I was working at the Dodge dealership, I saw that CarCraft magazine had an opening for editorial assistant, and I managed to get an interview. I went and saw Jeff Smith, who was the editor at the time. And what am I, 18 at this point? Look, punk, you know, he didn't literally call me a punk, but he said, you need to get some experience and come back. And ultimately I did. I ended up working at the dealership and I went from there to a machine shop. I was doing side jobs for Glendale Speed Center, which was a pretty big deal at the time. And I ended up working at Jacobs Electronics, which was an aftermarket ignition company. And through that, I got to know a lot of the magazine publishers, editors, staffers, because we were an advertiser in those books. Jacobs Electronics moved to Midland, Texas. I did that for a little while and decided that Texas wasn't for me at the time. I was a long-haired freak, Sunset Boulevard, heavy metal kid.
Hell yeah.
And that Midland was all Wranglers and Ropers. I was not really a fit. And I came back and I got an interview with Jeff Smith again. Mm-hmm. Of course, the guy who had interviewed me at CarCraft, but now he was the editor of Hot Rod. Mm-hmm. I interviewed with him and Pat Ganahl at the same time. Pat Ganahl was a guy who was also a legendary automotive journalist. He had worked, he had been the editor of Hot Rod, and he brought back Rod and Custom Magazine, was the editor there. And so Jeff ended up hiring me, and that was December of 1991. So that's how I got into Hot Rod Magazine.
Did he remember you when you went to that second?
No. He did not. Yeah. And I have told him the story multiple times subsequently, and he doesn't really have a remember, you know, trigger for it, but he's heard it enough that he can repeat it at this point. Mm-hmm. But from there, I became a staffer on Hot Rod. I went from there to being the editor of what they called SIP, single issue publications, one shots. And from there to Four Wheel and Off-Road, then CarCraft, then Rod and Custom, then Hot Rod. And while I was doing Hot Rod, there was a time I concurrently edited CarCraft and also launched Hot Rod Deluxe and ultimately Roadkill Magazine. And thus ends the saga of Freiberger in print.
Was that all under the same umbrella?
100% of that was under, well, I was hired under Peterson Publishing. Robert E. Peterson was the guy who founded Hot Rod in 1948.
Yeah.
I feel really lucky to have been one of the last people who worked directly with Robert E. Peterson.
Oh, that's cool.
John Diana was a guy who was legendary, who was more my direct report. And I end up being the last editor of Hot Rod who knew Robert E. Peterson, who knew Wally Parks, who was the first editor and who founded the National Hot Rod Association. And knowing a lot of those older guys who are really the pioneers of hot rodding, I was very fortunate to be able to meet them through that job.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
We did our other podcast is Automotive History.
Mm-hmm.
And we did one on Robert Peterson, and he lived such an amazing life
and
influenced so many people. We always talk about like back then the community was so small that everyone seems like the Forrest Gump. Of whatever,
like, you have like 45 different Forrest Gumps running around.
Yeah, this. And then he ran into, you know, Ken Miles, and they were like, let's.
People have accused me of that because when you're the editor of Hot Rod, you have a lot of opportunity.
Yeah.
You meet a lot of people in a lot of different realms of hot rodding.
Yeah.
But think of being Robert E. Peterson back in the day, and it's 1948, and you've launched this magazine. Yeah. You're a millionaire by like 1950.
And he was like a teenager at that point.
Close. He was probably 22.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Something like that.
Wow.
But his company was the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it that way.
Yeah.
If you wanted to know about cars, you went there because the magazines were your conduit of everything that was going on in hot rodding.
Yeah.
So if you were in Iowa somewhere, that was your connection.
When you were editing multiple magazines, how did you differentiate the voice between those publications?
I think those of us who worked at Peterson kind of had some swagger because we were like, we're the kings of the world here. We have access to absolutely everything.
Yeah.
We are the largest media outlet in cars, period. Motor Trend dominated the new car field. We dominated the hot rodding field. And of course, Peterson had so many other magazines. And if you were working at McMullen or Argus, or Schieffer, Dobbs, you kind of wanted to be at Peterson. Those were all like farm team to work your way up to Peterson. And so those of us who were there, obviously, we were a little bit cocky about it. But I always felt that I had a responsibility to the legacy. I never thought that this is me. It was Hot Rod. And Hot Rod had done so much and been so important that basically, I needed to not screw it up, and I needed to serve the reader as much as I possibly could. That said, when I was the editor of CarCraft, I saw that as being more of sort of the younger punk kid who sort of cops an attitude, and we would throw barbs at Hot Rod all time. And so those two magazines definitely had a very different voice.
Interesting.
So even if the crossover readership was pretty good, you would go to CarCraft to get sort of, you know, for lack of a better term, the roadkill stuff, the lower end stuff.
Yeah.
And you would go to Hot Rod when you wanted to be more serious about it. And I've always really enjoyed both parts of the industry. And at Hot Rod, I also really enjoyed being able to cover anything. you know, we did imports, which is an unfortunate story I can get into, but we were able to cover the Baja 1000 and the NHRA US Nationals and a guy building a hot rod in his backyard and Boyd Coddington. So
yeah, I remember really cool seeing when the S197 Mustang was first announced. That was on, I believe, on the cover of Hot Rod.
Yeah, we did late model cars as well if they were muscle cars.
Moving on to Roadkill. Did you pitch that, or was that pitched to you?
Yeah, how'd that come to be?
I had hired Mike Finnegan as a staffer on Hot Rod.
Yeah.
Right around this time, the internet was becoming a thing. And we had launched hotrod.com. I actually started all of the Hot Rod magazine social channels. Oh, wow. I literally signed up for Facebook and signed up for YouTube and signed up for Instagram for Hot Rod magazine. That's how, you know, we were really at the germ of this whole thing. Anyway, Finnegan was a staffer, and we were wanting to have more video on hotrod.com. And so we started just hiring a guy and going out and doing whatever we sort of felt like doing to have video to support the website. Right around this time, YouTube was cat videos, right? Mm-hmm. They wanted to compete with cable TV. And so YouTube went to, I think it was 100 different companies or 100 different channels, and said, we will pay you to make original content just for YouTube in long form. And the company that is now known as Motor Trend, that at the time, I mean, Peterson Publishing sold like 7 times while I was there. I worked for a litany of CEOs and under different companies, and I can't remember which one it was at the time. Let's say it was Prime Media or the Enthusiast Network. They had come to that company and said, you know, we want you to be the automotive, you know, leg of this. And so they were paying Motor Trend. YouTube was paying directly to make shows. Angus McKenzie was the editor in chief of Motor Trend at the time, and I reported to him as the editor of Hot Rod. And he loved what we were doing in video, and he came and said, you know, I can't mimic his accent. He's like an Englishman raised in Australia. He's got a unique sort of way of speaking. But he basically says, we need you guys to do this. Yeah. And what nobody really expected was that Roadkill was going to immediately rise to the top and smoke all of the new car programming. That's at the awesome. Time.
So you're kind of on the vanguard of all this, and you didn't even really like plan to do it.
Exactly. See, I can't take credit for any of this. It was just Finnegan and I doing what we wanted to do. And through happenstance, it landed and it became huge. Big part of that, through no control of our own, is because YouTube was paying for these shows, they promoted them to death. We did an episode that is actually one of my least favorites ever, which was Rat Rod versus Lamborghini. And so we had an Aventador and a Model A, and we drove around LA, and like, it was a weak episode, but it had a good headline, it had a good thumbnail, and YouTube absolutely promoted it to everybody. That put us on the map.
How many views does that one have now? Because I've seen it
55 million views on that one.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I think I'd have had it served to me a couple weeks ago.
Probably.
Yeah.
And this is why people recognize me at the grocery store. Yeah. It's a strange thing.
Finnegan was like working underneath you, and you just had a good rapport. And so you were like, come with me. We're going to go shoot this thing.
Yeah.
And then that turned into Roadkill. That's crazy.
Finnegan very much revitalized me.
Yeah.
When I was a magazine editor, I worked myself absolutely to the bone. I would do 36-hour shifts constantly. Because I was a terrible manager, I would do everything myself. I would rewrite everybody's stories. There came a point when I was laying out stories. I mean, I killed myself. And I had done that throughout my editorship of these magazines. And I was kind of burned down. But when I hired him, I don't know, there was a spark. We had fun. We were doing things together. The other people on staff at that time, I didn't really mesh in the sense. I mean, I loved all of them and they did a fantastic job, but we weren't the type of people who hung out in the garage pounding on stuff together. Yeah. And Finnegan and I did that. And I think that just always came across on camera. We're not the same guy by any means. And I think that's what played well on the show as well. I think I was always the narrator and he was more the impetus of crazy things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're in the same in the sense that like you're both fine letting the other take the lead for a second.
Oh, and, sure.
Like, you have a great rapport in that sense and great dynamic where like it makes it so watchable and you can watch a million episodes where like other shows, maybe there's a crazy dude that's crazy all the time and never comes back to Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Or like the person that wants to take charge and narrate the whole thing doesn't give the other person room to breathe. You were very respectful to each other the whole time while also kind of fucking with each other. And I really respect that.
I'm glad it came off that way because we never saw, well, okay. I had the slight edge as probably the lead because in the early days, Finnegan always referred me to me as the boss.
Yeah.
And I wasn't always that. But after those beginning days, I think we were always equals on the show. It wasn't like he was my sidekick or I was his sidekick. We were just two dudes doing our thing.
And you have complementary skills too and different like wheelhouses for like the Lowrider episode that we were talking about earlier. If you haven't seen this episode,
You have to. It's hilarious.
It's so fun.
If I do say so myself.
Finnegan chose the challenge and you chose the car without you guys knowing each other or what was going to happen. And you knew that he was going to pick an off-road challenge because you were really into off-roading, talked about it all the time. And so he did pick the off-road challenge, but you threw the wild card in there and bought a Lowrider at the Pomona swap meet.
Yeah.
It was like 1980
Monte Carlo.
On hydraulics.
On 13s. Yeah.
And it just so happened that Finnegan like had a background in lowriders, knew how to fix them a little bit.
Well, I don't know if he'd ever done hydraulics. He was into mini trucks, though. So he had definitely been into, you know, dragon frame and all of that. I remember when we were going to the reveal where I was going to show him the car.
Yeah.
He told me what we were going to do, which was he wanted to drive from LA to Vegas on dirt. Mm-hmm. I was crying. I was laughing so hard because I knew what was coming. Yeah, seriously, he and I don't think ever laughed as hard consistently throughout an episode as that one.
It's we so were fun.
Dying. Yeah. The car was so fun.
That's a classic roadkill episode.
The other one that I rewatched last night was the 240. With like 3.4 liter V6, the Chevy V6 in
the
it.
The Rotson. Yeah, it's a 4.3 liter Chevy.
Yeah.
Yeah, or was at the time.
And that made that kind of like hit home for me because you went to like an autocross in Arizona.
Yep.
And you were just like spewing liquid all over the track. You were like, they hate us here. Yeah. It just felt like, oh, like this is something Donut would do. Like we'd bring a car that would easily like just break down.
We've done that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, many times.
They're making fun of you over the loudspeaker. Like, so
I think here's one of the things that we probably, I won't say invented or triggered, we amplified it,
yeah.
Which was get a popular body style of a car that is clapped out and just get it running and driving. An example is the Rotson 240Z we were talking about, the General Mayhem, which was 68 Dodge Charger,
yeah.
The Disgusting, which was a 69 Mach 1. You know, they were beater muscle cars.
Mm, yeah.
But you know what? You get that shape, you get that feel, you get that coolness of having that car,
mm-hmm.
but then you put it together as cheaply as you can and you just go have fun with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we all agree that is now a huge trend.
100%.
And you see people putting Roadster Shop chassis and, you know, LS crate motors in clapped out bodies because paint causes stress. Whereas a dented up old car like that, you can go have fun with it.
Yeah.
And
it's something that we get as viewers too. Like you never seem stressed, even though, you know, like, it was the GMC, the 50 GMC that you got running.
Pig pen.
Yeah. And that was dying every 10 miles or something. And you're like, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to strap like a generator with crew, like production lights on the front and just get it as far as we can get it. And that's the polar opposite of how I treat cars where I'm like, I hope it doesn't die. And like, I'm just like, you know, dying of stress whenever I do that.
The thing I came up with for that is don't get it right, just get it running. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I think the sweatshirt says that on the back.
Yeah.
And people misinterpret that a bit because I'm not encouraging an unsafe car,
mm-hmm.
although we did plenty of that. what I'm actually saying is don't let a car fester in your garage mm-hmm. for 10 years because you need a perfect paint job before you can put an engine in it. Just get the thing running and driving. worry about it all later, because there's nothing more inspirational than driving your project car instead of having it soak up room and money in the garage where you're just stacking bicycles on it anyway.
Absolutely. That's one of my biggest car regrets is like with my 62 Dart, you know, I bought that when I was 15 or 16. And, you know, we had it in my dad's machine shop and, you know, we're tinkering with it. And the decision comes, it's like, okay, hey, we could go two routes with this thing. Like we could just get that slant six, the 225. The slant six was in there. It had a little bit of rust in like the floor pans and all that stuff. And it's like, okay, like we can go two routes. We can just get it patched up and you can drive this thing to school, or we could build a rotisserie, take it all apart, and try to restore this thing. And we chose that option in 2007. And then the next year, economy tanks. And then the car is still in pieces. My dad's still chipping away at it at our house. And I'm just like, we could have just patched that floor, you know, tuned the engine a little bit and had a lot more fun. It'd probably be in LA right now, you know? Get it running.
Yep. You mentioned 2007, which triggers another thing for me, which is, I worked for the publishing company for 33 years. You know, it started out in 1991 at Hot Rod. It ended late last year when I was gone from Roadkill. I was an employee the entire time, with the exception of 2007, 8, early 9, when I left to go start a thing that was called Car Junkie TV, which was streaming video.
That's right.
And it was way too soon. Nobody was doing it. And the economy tanked. Our investor moved back in with his mom and we folded up. And I was so lucky that a guy named Doug Evans, who was my boss at the time, hired me back at Hot Rod. Yeah. It was unheard of. If you left Hot Rod, you didn't come back.
Wow, really?
But he brought me back in, and then that saved my life and led to everything that it became since then.
Wow. You do have, if you look at all of your expertise, like, you know, writing AP English, working in shop class, and then working in publications for cars and stuff. And then also drama, drama department in the middle is like hosting car shows.
Yeah.
You also have kind of the same arc.
Very similar. I didn't even realize that. Yeah. Same kind of thing. Like definitely excelled in English in high school, did theater in high school, but also studied TV production in college. So never. Yeah.
And people in high school think you're a dork when you do drama, or at least they did in the 80s when I was doing it. But it did add up. The other thing is I briefly went to college. I don't have a degree, but I did a thing at Cal State LA, which was called Automotive Production Technology. And it was very light engineering, some writing, some photography.
Yeah. Wow.
And some management, and also hands-on wrenching. It's like, who ends up actually using their college career?
That's as, like, all perfect.
You know, and usually on it's the like nose as I did.
One part of, you know, your degree you're using in your career, you're literally using like everything that you've studied.
So I took all the classes in that major.
Yeah.
And I couldn't stand all of the general education stuff. And I remember walking out of a physics class one day, putting all my textbooks down on a planter, leaving the joint and never coming back.
What was the sketchiest roadkill trip?
We bought a flat fender Jeep that was called the Flat Rod, and it was I think it was a CJ that had a World War II grill in it, but it was all lowered down onto the ground. It was something that people called the Flat Rod. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tires hanging out, the fenders. It was the sketchiest build ever. You didn't sit in this thing as much as on it because it was all channeled, it was all down on the ground, didn't have seat belts. I can't believe we drove the thing on the freeway.
Mm-hmm.
The front suspension was ready to collapse at any minute. And ultimately, when we took the thing down a dirt road, it did.
I remember that
episode. We ended up going to a bar, and whoever picked up our bar bill got to win the Jeep. And so we went in there and just bought rounds for absolutely everybody and gave that Jeep away.
That's so funny.
It was probably the most dangerous thing that we did.
I think you did reference that in the Lowrider episode. Probably. Finnegan was like, please, not another Jeep or something. Right.
But, you know, we did a lot of stuff. Do you know Stubby Bob, our wheel standing truck? The fact that we drove that on the highway, and on one of our last episodes, we actually drove it from here all the way to Yuma, Arizona.
Oh my God.
And it got impounded on the way.
Really?
And I remember we got pulled over and the highway patrol walked up to us like, you can't drive this on the street. And Finnegan's like, why, officer? I mean, open headers, no license plates. We drove so many miles in unregistered cars.
Oh, yeah.
It's mind blowing. I mean, all the time, mm-hmm. cross country, no license plate whatsoever. I don't know how we got away with it like we did. Although the thing I always tell people is we were insured the whole time because we did have the corporate insurance on anything that was in the fleet. We didn't drive with no insurance.
Yeah.
But registration, optional.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
YouTube was giving you money at the time, but like, were YouTube, you really on a shoestring as much as you made it seem?
Yes and no. I always say we didn't fake anything on Roadkill.
Yeah.
We spent a whole lot more money than anybody thinks that we actually did. It was still dirt cheap for a television show.
Yeah.
I mean, bottom of the barrel dirt cheap. But in the early days, it was really pretty cheap. The longer we went and the shorter time that we had for production, which is a result of sort of the corporate snowball, you know, I ended up on four shows at the same time at one point.
Oh, shit.
And I probably ultimately did six of them. But for a long period of time, I did Roadkill, Roadkill Garage, and Engine Masters. And Finnegan had moved to Georgia.
Oh,
and
damn.
So we went from shooting shows over a period of several months, sort of on our own casual schedule. Like, I think it took 6 months to do the first General Mayhem episode and build that thing. And it came down to 5 to 7 days, sometimes as much as 10. And so when we would fly somewhere to pick up a vehicle that we were going to scab together and make run, we would end up buying way more than we actually needed because we didn't have time to run to parts stores. So we would look at it and say, just get a fuel pump, get a water pump, get a carburetor, get a bunch of fluids, get a bunch of zip ties. And so we would go make $1,000 run at the parts store before we got there, which is not anything that I do in my real life when I'm doing a real rescue like that, because why spend that kind of money?
Yeah.
But when you have 5 to 7 days and you're out of state and you need to get the thing put together, you kind of need to have the parts right
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I would say that's as fake as we got.
In a production timeline like that, that, I mean, those are the kind of timelines we have here. You know, usually it's like 5, 10 days and you just got to get it done. You know, the video's got to go, got to take that footage, get it to the editors as fast as possible. So you have to make those precautions.
We bought so many tool kits and floor jacks and jack stands. It was absurd.
Did you have other people working on it or was it just you two?
Just us.
Wow. That's crazy.
And if somebody else worked on it, we either told the audience or had them on camera. Lucky Costa, who was on the Hot Rod Garage show later on, he would do some off-screen stuff for us. Let's say we were scabbing something together and we didn't get the fuel system done. Occasionally, it would go off to him so that he could wrap that up. But on camera, I would always say, this went out to Lucky. He finished the fuel system for us. I know. I wasn't going to phony that up.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Do you feel like Roadkill directly led to some of these cars being unaffordable now? Because we have gone through the same thing where we mention a car and we'll see it uptick a little bit and we're like, what have we done?
I have to say, as a big time Mopar fan, you know, in the mid 2000s or early 2000s there, Mopars are definitely underappreciated, I would say, compared to, you know, the 69 Camaros and your Mustangs and all that. And then I'm like, okay, after college, maybe I'll get myself a Charger. And then now the Chargers
Nobody can
are
afford
the
a Charger anymore.
Yeah. Not anymore. No.
They're ridiculous.
Yeah.
But that's also natural market shift.
Sure.
Because I think what we see is 69 Camaros are super popular. And as they get more and more expensive, people go, well, I can live with a 70. 70s, I mean, for guys your age, were mainstreamed probably during your whole car buying life. But there was a time when no one wanted one. You could get them cheap.
Yeah.
Then it became, who wants a 74 with the ugly bumpers on it? Well, now you can kind of live with that. And we're at the point where four doors are okay, which they never were for muscle car guys before. So I think that the muscle car thing has now brought up every old rear wheel drive American car. So I can't take credit for that. If we popularized anything and made it more expensive, it's probably beaters. People will pay more for a car with good patina now than they will for a nice shiny one.
That's true.
You know, in some cases. So I think we probably drove that.
Hmm.
But once again, I will say not invented, but amplified.
We have to be a little bit cognizant about like what we mentioned, because there's some cars that we still want to buy.
I remember when square body trucks were Gardner trucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I have that one that's called the original muscle truck, which was on the show. That's a beater. I paid $1,500 for that thing. You can't touch those for $1,500 for a factory short bed 74 anymore. So I think all the stuff just comes up. I'm always hesitant to say, you know, I invented that. I made that trend happen.
Sure.
But as a magazine editor and TV guy, I think you definitely can amplify the stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. On that note, something I've been trying to think about is like, okay, cars, like everything from the early 2000s, that's cool now. Like 350Zs, those are getting expensive. S2000s can't afford WRXs. Is there anything in your mind, like trend forecasting between like 2010 and now, that you think might be underappreciated or like might have a resurgence in 5 years? Any cars in your mind, like anything that you see on the road that you're like, it'd be smart to buy one of those?
Kind of in the same way that third gen Camaros were worthless and now people want a lot of money for them. Yeah. I think that Mustangs, Camaros, Challengers will continue to sort of trickle up. I mean, it's always a predictable market force. The cars that were popular and hot when you were 17 are the ones that you buy when you're 40. And so as the generation goes on, assuming that we've done a good job keeping kids involved in cars, and I believe that, you know, there's so many people in the industry walking the SEMA show going, oh, it's a disaster. What are we going to do to get kids in cars? Cars don't, you know, kids don't drive anymore. Kind of wrong. And I think YouTube has driven that a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I was just at the Freedom 500. I announced there. And Cletus, talk about a guy who's driven a bunch of kids into this hobby.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to 27-year-olds there like, dude, I've been watching you since I was 13. Well, you know, that doesn't make me feel old, but but I'm glad that we triggered that in you. Yeah. Anyway, so we created those 13-year-olds who are now 27 and they're still into cars. And when they're 40, they're going to buy the car that they wanted when they were 17. And then that's going to drive up the value of those cars. Absolutely. It'll just keep going. Why is an OBS truck worth a fortune now? Yeah. You know,
that's kind of the
a Chevy GMT 400. Once again, worthless 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And now they're gold.
They're crazy now. Yep. I don't understand it.
You know, if you spend enough time on car YouTube, especially in like the revival genre of video, you'll hear like the, oh, we're going to do the roadkill trick. We threw two fuel filters on there. Are there any other kind of tricks that you learned along the way? Or not learned, but like techniques that you guys would employ over and over during these road trips to kind of help your cars get down the road and safeguard them like that?
Anything you see on Vice Grip Garage. So when Roadkill was taken off YouTube by the company, not by me, Derek at Vice Grip basically was a fan and said to himself, I can do this. And look at the empire that he has built out of it. Now, he does something slightly different than us. He's got a different character and he works way harder than we ever did. And so I'm taking zero away from him, but he popularized the revive and drive thing, in my opinion, which is why you see 100 guys trying to do that exact same thing now. He's got a lot of those tricks, some of which I disagree with. He uses the hose clamps that have the little wing on them so that you can tighten them by hand. I hate that because the wing breaks off and then it's got a little square stud and no tool on the planet other than maybe a vice grip can solve that. He uses that, what's it called? That gasoline in a can that you can buy at a parts store. He always uses that and it's a genius thing. He taught me that trick. Zip ties are, of course, the cliche roadkill and roadkill garage thing. You know, I can make anything out of a zip tie. I can probably, you know, make pistons out of it if I had to. So that's a big one.
In the GMC truck episode where you went to Fresno, you're like looking around for one screw for like, you went to like seven different trucks and you kept trying to unscrew it and it kept breaking. And you're like, fuck it, zip tie.
Yeah. You can get away with a lot with zip ties.
Yeah.
I would say my signature is zip ties.
Yeah.
And a hose clamp is just an advanced zip tie and a ratchet strap is a all hanging out zip tie.
So what are you driving right now?
Today I drove my 23 Challenger Scat Pack down here, which is very unusual. I bought that 2 years ago and it's got 6,500 miles on it. I never use it. I'm never in town. And if I'm just running local errands, I'll drive. I have a 90 Suburban I use all the time. In fact, I would have driven it down here if it wasn't loaded full of stuff. I have a 99 Ram I bought new that I use. I have a 69 Chevy C20 that is kind of my regular. There's a 74 Jeep Cherokee out front of my house that I'll hop in if it's blocking something else in the driveway.
Yeah.
So
what's your perfect weekend off-roading?
I am old enough that I now like exploring, I think, more than the hardcore rock crawling.
Yeah, or just like overlanding stuff.
No. Overlanding is a modern term for what we used to call car camping.
Yeah.
Or exploring.
Yeah.
Rick Payway, who is the editor of JP and Four Wheel and Off-Road Magazine, he and I recently drove a bone stock World War II flat fender Jeep from Los Angeles to Key West.
Holy shit.
And we will do that on as much dirt as we possibly can. So we will just get out our Gazetteer or get out the Onyx app and just take dirt roads as much as we possibly can.
How's your tailbone right now?
You know, everyone asks that about that. I have a crushed L5 disc. I can't handle a whole lot of that, but the flat fender is fine.
Nice. Wow. Very cool.
You can thank my L5 on Roadkill, too. I jumped a Buick wagon and just pancaked it.
Oh, God.
Exploded the disc.
Jesus.
Have you ever filmed a project that went so sideways that and horribly that it didn't make it to air?
I think so. I can't remember what it was. I think we started something. It would have been in the early days when we still had that luxury.
Gotcha. Yeah.
The very first episode we ever shot almost didn't make it to air because we didn't understand at the time that failing was going to be okay. And we had a goal to build this 69 Ford Ranchero, maybe it was a 68, and drive it from LA up to Alaska.
Wow.
And we got way behind schedule. We were punch drunk, sleep tired. We never made it out of the United States. We ended up at the bottom of the Grand Canyon and we went home and we were like, we failed so hard. We cannot launch our first episode and say we tried this and failed. We aired it as our second episode and people loved it. And that has been our signature ever since. And in all of my journalism career, my policy was always truth.
Yeah.
You know, you always win by being honest. Truth wins. And so I would never have faked a success when it didn't happen, but we absolutely learned that you can just admit it, just fail. And that's one of the reasons why Roadkill would have never made it as a TV show if the big conglomerate hadn't happened and they just absorbed it and needed content. If you went into a pitch meeting with any TV producer or network anywhere and said, yeah, we're going to make a car show. It's me and this guy. And the plot is basically, we're going to do whatever we feel like doing that week. If that's your elevator pitch, they go, no, get out. Because they can't predict the storyline. They can't predict the act breaks. Yeah. They can't establish a story arc. They can't give, you know, cliffhangers at the beginning of, you know, at the end of a commercial break and a recap when you come back in. They would never allow it.
Yeah.
But fortunately, the YouTube success allowed it, I think, to become a cable TV show that actually had really strong ratings.
Yeah. I mean, most people who are watching have failed more than they've
won. And that's the thing. It makes them go, these guys are just like me.
Yeah.
They're just maybe having more fun.
And that probably wasn't seen until you guys came out with that kind of format, because
think of another automotive show that started circa 2011.
Yeah.
That was doing anything like what we were doing. I always made fun of people wearing their golf shirt, standing in the pristine shop with the lift where magically grease never gets on their hands.
Yeah.
And they're talking about how great the advertiser part is. You know, that's what was going on automotive TV at the time. That or the we're going to lose the shop, throw wrenches at each other shtick.
We'll be right back after these messages. Now back to the show.
The image that sticks out to me, just because it, I refreshed with a bunch of episodes, but Finnegan under the truck in Fresno, just like on the parts, on the phone with the parts store, like laying on like sound blanket or something, just like defeated, like, oh my God, what is this? What is happening right now in the dust?
It's real.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so relatable.
We suffered a lot for the show.
Oh, I bet you did.
We really did. We're driving in the freezing cold, blazing hot, no windshield.
Oh, God.
You know, bouncing down the road, wrenching on stuff in the middle of nowhere.
It is amazing that you didn't get pulled over more. Like, with all these.
We got pulled over. Yeah. I am like Teflon to tickets. It's very strange. My whole deal is be completely honest with the officer and treat them with complete respect, and they usually will appreciate it and let you go.
Yeah. Good tip. Policy.
We got away with some just crazy stuff. One time I got pulled over, we were driving the Crusher Camaro, and I don't even remember what state this was, but I buzzed past an accident scene, and they were on the inside, so they were off to my left as I was in the fast lane, and cop comes chasing after me. He's irate. He comes up, is like, "You buzzed past me. My partner had to pull me off the highway. You know, you're dangerous. This is, you're required to change lanes and everything. Come here." He sits me in his car, reads me the riot act, writes me up a ticket. And when he's all done, I go, "You know what, officer? That was completely unintentional. I really appreciate the job that you guys do. And I have no intent of causing you any harm. So I apologize." And I shook the guy's hand, and he looked at me, and he was kind of shocked. And when I received the ticket in the mail, it was dismissed.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
When you guys did make the jump from internet to TV, were there any changes or tweaks that the network kind of suggested, or were there, how'd you guys have to change the show, or did you?
We didn't.
At all?
Nope.
No.
Same thing. That grew as it went on. So to give you sort of the laser version of this, I told you how the company sold a whole bunch of times. At some point, the magazine publishing company did a joint venture with Discovery, like Discovery Network, a million cable channels. And at almost the same time, Discovery was joining with Warner Brothers. And so I became a Warner Brothers Discovery employee. And it's very strange for TV talent to be an employee of the cable network that's airing it. It's really unusual. And Finnegan went the other way. He was a freelancer.
Was that an option given to you?
I could have been a freelancer. Yeah. I chose to have the stability. I shouldn't have. I would have made a ton more money if I had gone freelance, because I was not allowed to do my own YouTube channel. I wasn't allowed to sell my own apparel. But being risk adverse, I chose the medical insurance and the steady paycheck. Towards the end, I would say the last 2 or 3 years, the only change that came in is we had more and more and more staff, more producers, and they started to bug us for that that cliffhanger before a commercial and that recap after a commercial. Yeah. We did that in a very weak and lame passive aggressive way because we didn't want to. That's the only pressure that we ever really felt about it. No one ever came and sat us down and said, "We need you to throw more wrenches. We need you to lose the shop. We need to script this. We need you to," I mean, none of that happened.
It was more just like, "Oh, I hope it's going to start." Like that kind of stuff.
That was about, the cliffhanger. Sometimes they would edit them in even if we hadn't done it.
Oh, God.
Because we naturally would be like, "Dude, we're screwed."
Yeah.
And they would just cut there. Because that was the moment.
That sounds like they somewhat knew. I mean, they knew what they had, and knew that did have those demands.
Unexpectedly, our ratings were huge when they first dropped us on the channel. We were the number one show on the channel for maybe a year after we first dropped, and then it did come back. The number one shows were really Bitchin' Rides and Iron Resurrection and those types of shows. But we were always top five even after. You know, that initial surge and then drop, we remained top five. The other show that I did was called Engine Masters, mm-hmm. which was just dyno testing parts.
Love that show.
And I always told them, "Don't put this on cable TV. Nothing moves."
Yeah.
It's three old guys who look like a leftover roller dog talking about horsepower, you know, but they put it on the network and it landed and it did really well for a long time. It did taper off to the point that it was canceled before the other shows went down. And when we were canceled, it wasn't like Roadkill is bad now, you're fired. They wiped out the whole network, essentially, or not the whole network. The Motor Trend network still exists. They're still rerunning us. They still have some new shows, but they killed all of the original productions in the in-house production companies, basically what happened.
Speaking of dead meat, did
what?
The roller dog. The coyote in the intro.
Yes.
When did you find that coyote, and did PETA ever come after you?
On our very first trip, the one that was our first shoot that we didn't air until the second one.
Yeah.
That was a coyote at the side of the road.
Oh my God.
And we're like, whoa, this is perfect. And so the director hopped out and got that low angle shot of us buzzing by with the ranchero that was in the opening credits all the way for 13 years.
It's such a grim image.
It's really jarring. Like when you forget, like you go back and watch, you're like, yeah. Oh,
you should have seen it before we CG'd out the intestines lying on the ground.
Oh God.
Yes. It was gruesome.
Jeez.
Yeah. And yes, in the early years, we did get some comments of like, how could you do that? It's like, did you guys hit that dog?
Yeah.
You know,
your director's like, all right.
That dog
now.
Guys, do not let me forget before we wrap. We have to hit a coyote.
Yeah. It's integral to the intro. Yeah.
And the show was called Roadkill before we shot a first frame. We just came up with that. We thought that a guy named Brandon Galogli, who was I have a lunch with him coming up that I don't think I calendared. I'm sitting here going, was that today? Was it? I'm going to think about that for the rest of this now. Anyway, Finnegan and I thought that he came up with the name, but then someone else contradicted that recently, but that's our recollection. And it was the name of a magazine that I was launching that was about rat rods and stuff.
That's cool.
And it was so cool that the guy, Angus McKenzie, was like, come on, mate. It's like, that's the poo right there. Yeah. And so that became the name of the TV show, and the magazine, which lasted two issues, was called Overkill.
Oh, that's cool. So obviously you came up with all the names for the cars too, right? Or was that
not me?
A combination of
us.
You? Yeah.
Yeah. Or sometimes they would come from the fans or from one of the guys on the crew. I have a real hypocritical view on car names.
Okay.
Which is, you know, I'm fairly well known for having come up with a whole bunch of stuff. You know, like General Mayhem and, you know, the Dragoneer is one of my recent ones. It's a drag racing Jeep Wagoneer. The Dragwar, our Jaguar.
The Dragwar was cool,
you know, we came up with a lot of stuff. NASCARLO. But I always say, I hate it when people will buy a project car and go on social media and go, what do I name it? Every car does not need a name.
Yeah.
If it doesn't come naturally, if it's not a fit, don't force it.
Yeah.
That is weak.
Agreed. Yeah.
And if you can't come up with it yourself, and if it's not what you and your friends naturally just call the thing, I have a car that's called the Red Duster because Steve Dulcich and I were just like, you know, we had five Dusters. It was the red one. Mm-hmm. That's just what we called it. It's not creative. It's just what we called it.
Yeah.
And so is this other stuff. I don't like the buy a car and immediately, oh, well, this has to have a name. And I think that came out of the magazines because that's where car names came from.
It's got to speak to you.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're not bonded with the car, don't do it. You know, my first car I still own. It's a 1970 Dodge Super B.
Wow.
It doesn't have a name. The license plate says Rumble B, but I don't call it that. So that's not what it is. It's just my Super B. I also don't like people names for cars. You know, we have Stubby Bob, but I don't like, you know, my parents Rhonda. Have a Grand Cherokee and they call it Elliot.
Elliot?
No, I don't like people names like that on cars.
Elliot the Jeep.
Yeah.
Right.
Hilarious. For a while, I was naming my cars like Carlos, Carla. They just all had car on them, but I was like, that was more of just like.
Well, that has some merit. I mean, if that's your thing, that's funny. You know, Carmen.
Carmen was one of them. Carmen was a 2004 Saturn L300 station wagon. And it treated me well for a year, and then it just died.
Station wagon, I would have called it cargo.
Ah, damn it. Okay, well.
See, and I would name it that. If it was a fast station wagon, it would be cargo.
Yeah, cargo. This cargo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I missed that wagon.
Yep.
What's next for David Freiberger?
Not making TV shows anymore. People ask me all the time, when are you going to get back on TV? I don't have that burning desire because, as I said, you're never going to pitch a show to a producer and be able to just do whatever you want like Finnegan and I did ever. And I have zero desire to be on TV so bad that I'm going to sign up for a show where I have to be fake. But that said, I was fortunate that my friends at National Hot Rod Association contacted me and said, we would like for you to come do NHRA on Fox. And so I'm a pit reporter, and I'm a pit reporter for NHRA on Fox, and which is National Hot Rod Association. For those of you who don't know, it's professional drag racing. And I also do in-venue announcing.
Very cool.
That's really cool.
And so I'm doing that 8 times a year. I've done 2 of them. I found out that being a drag racing super fan does not prepare you with everything that you need to know. And I'm learning real TV stuff, like having a director talking in your ear while you're interviewing someone,
that's a skill.
Or while you're presenting something and they're going, you know, 20 seconds, 10, 5, you know, or they're saying, you know, ask them this. And you're thinking to yourself, I don't want to ask him, you know, or I tend to go the other way where I'll ask something. And they're like, that was a little harsh, you know, something like that.
I feel like they have to understand who you are when they hire you to be an announcer, too. Like they have to know your voice, that you're going to be maybe a little bit edgier than, you know, ask him.
That's the thing that they have liked about it. Yeah. Fortunately, if they said, man, you're really natural. You're yourself. You have a different presentation style.
Yeah.
And I feel like even through all of the roadkill stuff, which is like the fart jokes of TV shows, I still feel like I'm a journalist.
Yeah.
You know, I tell the truth about things. I report things the way they are. I analyze things, and I can bring that to what I'm doing on these interviews, but do it in a more casual sort of, maybe not flippant way, but more like I'm just a dude telling people what's going on. And they have liked that.
I think that's super relatable.
So I'm doing that with NHRA, which is cool. Cause the other thing I'm doing is I've gone all the way into YouTube. I'm posting every single week, Thursdays at 3. It's called the David Freiberger channel. And the thing I'm doing wrong on YouTube is I think what YouTube wants you to do is the same video every single week and be completely predictable. And I do it more like I did Hot Rod Magazine, which is trucks over here, cars over there, lowrider, you know, just all over the map. Sometimes I sit in my garage and talk to people about history. Other times I do basically a roadkill, hit the road and fix stuff in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's been going pretty well.
Yeah. I mean, you're definitely right about the algorithm and like that consistency. But I think in your case, like people, the audience will come, obviously. I mean, you're an institution, I think, on the platform. They'll find you.
It's going pretty well. I'm picking up 300 to 1,000 subs a day.
That's great.
Yeah. And I'm at 390 right now. I think my views are higher than would be indicated by the subscriber count. So I'm feeling pretty good about it. I'm still a newbie. I still have stuff to learn. It's hard to keep up a weekly pace by yourself.
Absolutely. Really hard.
Yeah.
And
are you
so
editing everything
that
too?
No, that's the thing I decided I was not going to do when I drove in. I was like, you know what? I'm just not going to learn that skill. I'm going to shuffle that off to someone else. I'm cutting my profits, you know, by a third by doing that.
I think that's the right call though. Honestly, there's a lot of YouTubers out there that still edit their own and it just,
that's
at a certain point,
out.
It burns you out even faster. Yeah. Because, you know, it's a good thing to have that much ownership over your own output, but I mean, it just kills you, just drives you down.
I'm very lucky to have some really good guys who will work for pennies. and I've told them, you know, if I grow and make more money, I'm willing to throw you more money.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. We will drop a link down below.
Thank you.
Yeah. Make sure you
David's
subscribe.
Channel. We did a walkthrough of our parking lot with you beforehand.
Yes, we did.
And we do have a lot of imports. I know you're an American car guy. If you were to drive any of our cars out of the parking lot today, which one would you drive?
The Ranger with the 454 LS. Oh, yeah.
Same.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or the loner car that isn't even yours. Yeah.
We have the little
The slingshot. You want to take our slingshot?
Yeah. We have a GT86
right.
From Toyota.
Yeah.
Are there any cars? I mean, that people would maybe
Isn't
be
it GR86.
GR86. Yeah. I'm sorry. It was Hakone called the GT edition. 86 like 10 years ago.
Gazoo Racing.
Yeah. Yes. Thanks for correcting me. Are there any cars out there that people might be like surprised that you're into, you know, or that you desire besides a GR86?
I don't feel shamed by a Miata. I would drive that around, and I think that shocks people. The GR86, I would almost own. It's a little small for me, but I think that little sports cars with four cylinders and sticks and rear-wheel drive are a riot on an autocross. They might not be the fastest thing, but I'm big into it's more fun to drive a slow car fast than a fast car slow. Big into that. Let's see. What did we? I would have your Chrysler.
Chrysler. Yeah, yeah. The
52 Imperial. Yeah. You know, that's swank.
Thank you. Yeah. I get too busy here and don't have enough time to like actually work on my own stuff, but I really want to get that thing like out of here. It runs great. It's like drives and starts and runs great down the road. It just needs like an exhaust pipe on it. It's too loud. And then I'll just take it home to the west side and park it there. But I really love that car. And I think, I probably wouldn't own that car if not for,
I encouraged garbage.
Yeah.
Perfect.
So I think that's a great place to end there.
Yeah. Dude, David, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
You know, how I complain about talking about myself for an hour.
No. Yeah. I mean, you are such an inspiration to everyone in this building.
Thank you.
And you can obviously see it come through in our videos and stuff. And I think you've inspired our whole generation for, you know, going out there, taking not the most ideal car and fixing it up and making it your own.
Just having fun. Yeah. Having fun with it.
Let's make sure to throw Finnegan in that mix too.
Yeah, absolutely. Finnegan. Yeah. We're going to get him in here one day, maybe.
That'd be great too.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. And once again, follow his channel. We'll drop a link down here. The David Freiberger channel.
That's it.
Every Thursday, you said?
Every Thursday at 3.
Cool. Yeah.
Pacific.
Pacific time. So you in Japan, you're going to have to get up pretty early.
All right. Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you guys very much. It's been fun.
Yeah. And do you want to plug your Instagram?
All my social media is my name. So it's the David Freiberger on YouTube. It's David Freiberger on Facebook and Instagram and also on Threads. And you can buy my stuff at shop.davidfreiberger.com as well.
Get yourself a hoodie.
Do all of that. And follow us at Donut Podcasts on Instagram. Subscribe if you haven't and tell your friends. We spread via word of mouth, just like the cold that we both share.
Yeah.
And we'll see you next week.
By the way.
If you haven't already, click the link below and fill out the podcast tour link so we know where to go for our live US tour, which is still in the works. And we'll see you next week. Thank you.